I let him go and went to the kitchen. Do you know, Mary was right. The Tempest Fugit drug is no good for honeymoons. The ecstatic happiness that I had felt before was masked by the euphoria of the drug. Though I did not feel the loss at the time because the drug's euphoria is compelling. But the loss was real. I had substituted, for the true magic, a chemical fake. And there are some precious things which cannot or should not be hurried. Mary was right, as usual. Nevertheless, it was a good day, or month, however you care to look at it. But I wish that I had stuck to the real thing. Late that evening, we came out of it. I felt the slight irritability which marks the loosening hold of the drug. Found my ring watch and timed my reflexes. When they were back to normal, I timed Mary's. Whereupon she informed me that she had been out of it for 20 minutes or so. Pretty accurate matching of dosage, to have been based on body weights only. "Do you want to go under again?" she asked me. I pulled her to me and kissed her. "No. Frankly, I'm glad to be back." "I'm so glad." I had the usual ravenous appetite that one has afterward, no matter how many times one eats while under. I mentioned it. "In a minute," she said. "I want to call Pirate. He has not been in all day." I had not missed him during the day, or month, just past. The euphoria is like that. "Don't worry about it," I told her. "He often stays out all day." "He has not before." "He has with me," I answered. I think I offended him. I know I did. "Then he is probably down at old John's. That is his usual way of punishing me when he does not like the service." "He'll be all right." "But it's late at night. I'm afraid a coyote might get him." "Don't be silly. There are no coyotes this far east." "A fox, then, or something. Do you mind, darling? I'll just step out and call him." She headed for the door. "Put on something, then," I ordered. "It will be nippy out there." She hesitated, then went back to the bedroom and got a negligee I had bought for her the day we had gone down to the village. She went out. I put more wood on the fire and went into the kitchen. She must have left the door dilated, for while I was trying to make up my mind between convenience of a soup to nuts and the pleasure of planning a meal from separate units, I heard her say, "Bad, bad cat. You worried, Mama," in that cooing voice suitable for babies and felines. I called out, "Fetch him in and close the door, and mind the penguins." She did not answer, and I did not hear the door relax. So I went back into the living room. She was just coming in and did not have the cat with her. I started to speak and then caught sight of her eyes. They were staring, filled with unspeakable horror. I said, "Mary," and started toward her. She seemed to see me and turned back toward the door. Her movements were jerky, spasmodic. As she turned, I saw her shoulders. Under the negligee was a hump. I don't know how long I stood there. Probably a split second, but it is burned into me as endless. I jumped toward her and grabbed her by the arms. She looked at me, and her eyes were no longer wells of horror, but merely dead. She gave me the knee. I squeezed and managed to avoid the worst of it. "Look, I know you don't tackle a dangerous opponent by grabbing his upper arms, but this was my wife. I couldn't come at Mary with a faint shift and kill." But the slug had no compunctions about me. Mary, or it, was giving me everything she had, and I had all I could do to keep her from killing me. I had to keep her from killing me, and I had to kill the slug. And I had to keep the slug from getting at me, or I would not be able to save her. I let go with one hand, and jabbed at her chin. The blow should have knocked her out, but it did not even slow her down. I grabbed again, with both arms and legs, trying to encase her in a bear hug to immobilize her without injuring her. We went down together, Mary on top. I shoved the top of my head into her face to stop her biting me. I held her so, curbing her strong body by sheer bulk of muscle. Then I tried to paralyze her with nerve pressure, but she knew what I was up to, knew the key spots as well as I did, and I was lucky that I was not myself paralyzed. There was one thing left that I could do, clutch the slug itself. But I knew the shattering effect that had on the host. It might not kill her. Again, it might. It was sure to hurt her horribly. I wanted to make her unconscious, then remove the slug gently before I killed it, drove it off with heat, or force it to turn loose with mild shocks. Drive it off with heat. But I was given no time to develop the idea. She got her teeth in my ear. I shifted my right arm and grabbed at the slug. Nothing happened. Instead of sinking my fingers into a slimy mess, I found that this slug had a horny, leathery covering. It was as if I had clutched a football. Mary jerked when I touched it. I took away part of my ear. But there was no bone-crushing spasm. The slug was still alive and in control of her. I tried to get my fingers under it, to pry it loose. It clung like a suction cup. My fingers would not go under. In the meantime, I was suffering damages in other places. I rolled over and got to my knees, still hugging her. I had to let her legs free, and that was bad. But I bent her across a knee and then struggled to my feet. I dragged and carried her to the fireplace. She knew what I was doing, and almost got away from me. It was like trying to wrestle a mountain lion. But I got her there, grabbed her by her mop of hair, and slowly forced her shoulders over the fire. I swear that I meant only to singe it, force it to drop off to escape that heat. But she struggled so hard that I slipped, banged my own head against the arch of the opening, and dropped her shoulders against the coals. She screamed and bounded out of the fire, carrying me with her. I struggled to my feet, still dazed by the wallop I had taken in the head, and saw her collapsed on the floor. Her hair, her beautiful hair, was burning. And so was her negligee. I slapped at them both with my hands. The slug was no longer on her. Still crushing the flames with my hands, I glanced around and saw it lying on the floor in front of the fireplace. And Pirate was sniffing at it. "Get away from there," I yelled. "Pirate, stop that!" The cat looked up inquiringly, as if this were some new and interesting game. I went on doing what I had to do, making absolutely certain that the fire was out, both hair and clothing. When I was sure, I left her. But there was not even time to make certain that she was still alive. There was something more urgent to do. What I wanted was the fireplace shovel. I did not dare risk touching the thing with my hands. I turned to get the shovel. But the slug was no longer on the floor. It had gotten Pirate. The cat was standing rigid, feet wide apart, and the slug was settling into place. Perhaps it would have been better had I been a few seconds later. Perhaps the slug, mounted on the cat, would have escaped outdoors. I would not have pursued it into the dark. I don't think I would have. But I dived at Pirate and got him by his hind legs just as he made his first controlled movement. Handling a frenzied full-grown cat with bare hands is reckless at best. Controlling one which is already controlled by a titan is impossible. Hands and arms being slashed by claws and teeth at every step, I hurried again to the fireplace. This time, I made sure. Despite Pirate's wails and struggles, I forced the slug against the coals and held it there, cat fur and my hands alike burning, until the slug dropped off directly into the flames. Then I took Pirate out and laid him on the floor. He was no longer struggling. I did for him what I had done for Mary, made sure that he was no longer burning anywhere, and went back to Mary. She was still unconscious. I squatted down beside her. and sobbed. An hour later, I had done what I could for Mary. Her hair was almost gone from the left side of her head, and there were burns on her shoulders and neck. But her pulse was strong, her respiration steady, though fast and light, and I did not judge that she would lose much body fluid. I dressed her burns. I keep a rather full stock out there in the country, and gave her an injection to make her sleep. Then I had time for Pirate. He was still on the floor where I had left him, and he did not look good. He had gotten it much worse than Mary, and probably flame in his lungs as well. I thought he was dead, but he lifted his head when I touched him. "I'm sorry, old fella," I whispered. "I think I heard him mew." I did for him what I had done for Mary, except that I was afraid to give him a soporific. After that, I went into the bathroom and looked myself over. The ear had stopped bleeding, and I decided to ignore it for the time being. Someday, when I had time, it would need to be rebuilt. My hands were what bothered me. I stuck them under hot water and yelped, then dried them in the air blast, and that hurt too. I could not figure out how to dress them, and besides, I needed to use them. Finally, I dumped about an ounce of the jelly for burns into each of a pair of plastic gloves, and put them on. The stuff included a local anesthetic. I could get by. Then I went to the stereophone and called the village medical man. I explained to him carefully and correctly what had happened, and what I had done about it, and asked him to come at once. "At night?" he said. "You must be joking." I said that I decidedly was not joking. He answered, "Don't ask the impossible, man. Yours makes the fourth alarm in this county. Nobody goes out at night. You've done everything that can be done tonight. I'll stop in and see your wife first thing in the morning." I told him to go straight to the devil first thing in the morning, and switched off. Pirate died a little after midnight. I buried him at once so that Mary would not see him. Digging hurt my hands, but he did not take a very big hole. I said goodbye to him and came back in. Mary was resting quietly. I brought a chair to the bed and watched over her. Probably I dozed from time to time. I can't be sure. 23. About dawn, Mary began to struggle and moan. I stepped to the bed and put a hand on her. "There, baby, there. It's all right. Sam's here." Her eyes opened, and for a moment held the same horror they had held when she was first possessed. Then she saw me and relaxed. "Sam, oh, darling, I've had the most terrible dream." "It's all right," I repeated. "Why are you wearing gloves?" She became aware of her own dressings. She looked dismayed and said, "It wasn't a dream." "No, dearest, it wasn't a dream. But it's all right, I killed it." "You killed it? You're sure it's dead?" "Quite sure." The house still reeked with the stench of its dying. "Oh, come here, Sam, hold me tight." "I'll hurt your shoulders." "Hold me." I did so, while trying to be careful of her burns, although she seemed indifferent to them. Presently, her trembling slowed down and stopped almost completely. "Forgive me, darling, I'm being weak and womanish. You should have seen the shape I was in when they got me back." "I did see. Now tell me what happened, I must know. The last I remembered, you were trying to force me into the fireplace." "Look, Mary, I couldn't help it. I had to. I couldn't get it off." She shook my shoulders, and now It was she comforting me. I know, darling, I know. And thank you for doing it. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Again, I owe you everything. We both cried a bit, and presently I blew my nose and went on. You did not answer when I called you, so I went into the living room and there you were. I remember. Oh, darling, I tried so hard. I stared at her. I know you did. You tried to leave, but how could you? Once a slug gets you, that's it. There's no way to fight it. Well, I lost, but I tried. There was no answer to the mystery. Somehow, Mary had forced her will against that of a parasite, and that can't be done. I know. True, she had succumbed, but I knew then that I was married to a human who was tougher and stronger than I was, despite her lovely curves and her complete femininity. I had a sneaking hunch that had Mary not been able to resist the slug by some amount, however slight, I would have lost the struggle, handicapped as I was by what I could not do. I should have used a light, Sam, she went on, but it never occurred to me to be afraid here. I nodded. This was a safe place, like crawling into bed or into sheltering arms. Pirate came at me at once. I didn't see the thing until I reached down and touched him. Then it was too late. She sat up, supporting herself on one arm. Where is he, Sam? Is he all right? Call him in. So I had to tell her about Pirate. She listened without expression, nodded, and never referred to him again. I changed the subject by saying, Now that you are awake, I had better fix you some breakfast. Don't go! I stopped. Don't go out of my sight at all, she went on. Not for any reason. I'll get up in a moment and get breakfast. The hell you will. You'll stay right in that bed like a good little girl. Come here and take off those gloves. I want to see your hands. I did not take them off. Could not bear to think about it. The anesthesia had worn off. She nodded and said grimly, Just as I thought. You were burned worse than I was. So, she got breakfast. Furthermore, she ate. I wanted nothing but a pot of coffee. I did insist that she drank a lot, too. Large area burns are no joke. Presently, she pushed aside her plate, looked at me and said, Darling, I'm not sorry it happened. Now I know. Now we've both been there. I nodded humbly, knowing what she meant. Sharing happiness is not enough. She stood up and said, Now we must go. Yes, I agreed. Now we must go. I want to get you to a doctor as soon as possible. I don't mean that. I know you don't. There was no need to discuss it further. We both knew that the music had stopped, and that now was time to go back to work. The heap we had arrived in was still sitting on my landing flat, piling up rental charges. It took about 3 minutes to burn the dishes, switch off everything but the permanent circuits, and get ready. I could not find my shoes, but Mary remembered where I had left them. Mary drove because of my hands. Once in the air, she turned to me and said, Let's go straight to the section offices. We'll get treatment there and find out what has been going on. Or are your hands hurting too badly? Suits, I agreed. My hands were hurting, but they would not be any worse for another hour of waiting. I wanted to learn the situation as soon as possible, and I wanted to get back to work. I asked Mary to switch on the squawk screen. I was as anxious to catch the newscast now as I had been anxious to avoid them before. But the car's communication equipment was as junky as the rest of it. We could not even pick up audio. Fortunately, the remote control circuits were still okay, or Mary would have had to bucket through traffic by hand. A thought had been fretting me for some time. I mentioned it to Mary. A slug would not mount a cat just for the hell of it, would it? I suppose not. But why? It doesn't make sense. But it has to make sense. Everything they do makes sense. Grisly sense from their viewpoint. But it did make sense. They caught a human that way. Yes, I know, but how can they plan it? Surely there aren't enough of them that they can afford to place themselves on cats, on the off chance that the cat might catch a human. Or are there enough? I remembered the speed with which a slug on an ape's back had turned itself into two. I remembered Kansas City, saturated, and shivered. Why ask me, darling? I don't have an analytical brain. Which was true, in a way. There is nothing wrong with Mary's brain, but she jumps logic and arrives at her answers by instinct. Me, I have to worry it out by logic. Drop the modest little girl act and try this on for size. The first question is, where did the slug come from? It didn't walk. It had to get to the pirate on the back of another host. What host? I'd say it was old John. John the goat. I doubt if pirate would have let any other human get close to him. Old John? Mary closed her eyes, then opened them. I can't get any feeling about it. I was never close to him. It doesn't matter. By elimination, I think it must be true. Old John wore a coat when everyone else was complying with the bareback order, getting away with it because he shuns people. Ergo, he was hag-ridden before schedule bareback. But that does not get me any further. Why would a slug single out a hermit way up in the mountains? To capture you. Me? To recapture you. It made some sense. Possibly any host that ever escaped them was a marked man. In that case, the dozen-odd congressmen and others we had rescued, including Mary, were in special danger. I'd mark that down to report for analysis. No, not Mary. The only slug that knew she had been possessed was dead. On the other hand, they might want me in particular. What was special about me? I was a secret agent. More important, the slug that had ridden me must have known what I knew about the old man, and known that I had access to him. That would be reason enough to try to get me back. I held an emotional certainty that the old man was their principal antagonist. The slug must have known that I thought so. He had full use of my mind. That slug had even met the old man, talked with him. Wait a minute. That slug was dead. My theory came tumbling down. And built up again at once. Mary, I asked, have you used your apartment since the morning you and I had breakfast there? No, why? Don't. Don't go back there for any purpose. I recall thinking, while I was with them, that I would have to booby-trap it. Well, you didn't, did you? Or did you? No, I did not. But it may have been booby-trapped since then. There may be the equivalent of old John waiting, spider-fashion, for you, or me, to return there. I explained to her McIlvaine's theory about the slugs, the group memory idea. I thought at the time he was spinning the dream stuff scientists are so fond of. But now I don't know. It's the only hypothesis I can think of that covers everything, unless we assume that the Titans are so stupid that they would have as soon tried to catch a fish in a bathtub as in a brook, which they aren't. Just a moment, dear. By Dr. McIlvaine's theory, each slug is really every other slug. Is that it? In other words, that thing that caught me last night was just as much the one that rode you when you were with them as the one that actually did ride you. Oh, dear, I'm getting confused. I mean, that's the general idea. Apart, they are individuals. In direct conference, they merge their memories, and Tweedledum becomes exactly like Tweedledee. Then, if that is true, this one last night remembers everything it learned from me, provided it had direct conference with the slug that rode me, or any other slug that had. Or a slug that had been linked through any number of slugs by direct conference to the slug that had written me, after the time it did, which you can bet it did, from what I know of their habits. It would have, the first one, I mean. Wait a minute. This is getting involved. Take three slugs. Joe, Moe, and, Herbert. Herbert is the one last night. Moe is the one which... Why give them names, if they are not individuals? Mary wanted to know. Just to keep them... No reason. Let it lie that if McIlvaine is right, there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of slugs, who know exactly who you and I are, by name and by sight and everything. Know where your apartment is, where my apartment is, and where our cabin is. They've got us on a list. But... She frowned. That's a horrid thought, Sam. How would they know when to find us at the cabin? You didn't tell anybody we were going, and I didn't even know. Would they simply stake it out and wait? Yes, I suppose they would. They must have. We don't know that waiting matters to a slug. Time may mean something entirely different to them. Like Venerians, she suggested. I nodded. A Venerian is likely as not to marry his own great-great-granddaughter and be younger than his descendants. It depends on how they estimate, of course. In any case, I went on, I've got to report this, including our guesses as to what is behind it, for the boys in the analytical group to play with. I was about to go on and say that, if we were right, the old man would have to be especially careful, as it was he, and not Mary and myself, that they were after. But my phone sounded for the first time since my leave had started. I answered, and the old man's voice cut in ahead of the talkers. Report in person. We're on our way, I acknowledged. About 30 minutes. Make it sooner. You use K5. Tell Mary to come in by L1. Move. He switched off before I could ask him how he had known that Mary was with me. Did you get it? I asked Mary. Yes, I was in the circuit. Sounds as if the party was about to start. It was not until we had landed that I began to realize how drastically the situation had changed. We were complying with Schedule Bareback. We had not heard of Schedule Suntan. Two cops stopped us as we got out. Stay where you are, one of them ordered. Don't make any sudden moves. You would not have known they were cops, except for the manner and the drawn guns. They were dressed in gun belts, shoes, and skimpy breech cloths. Little more than straps. A second glance showed their shields clipped to their belts. Now, the same one went on, off of those pants, buddy. I did not move quickly enough to suit him. He barked, make it snappy. There have been two shot trying to escape already today. You may be the third. Do it, Sam, Mary said quietly. I did. My shorts were a one-piece garment, with the underwear part built in. Without them, I stood dressed in my shoes and a pair of gloves. feeling like a fool. But I had managed to keep both my phone and my gun covered up as I took off my shorts. The cop made me turn around. His mate said, "He's clean. Now the other one." I started to put my shorts back on, and the first cop stopped me. "Hey, you looking for trouble? Leave him off." I said reasonably, "You've searched me. I don't want to get picked up for indecent exposure." He looked surprised, then guffawed, and turned to his mate. "You hear that, Ski? He's afraid he'll be arrested for indecent exposure." The second one said patiently, "Listen, yokel, you gotta cooperate, see? You know the rules. You can wear a fur coat for all of me. But you won't get picked up for indecent exposure. You get picked up for DOA. The vigilantes are a lot quicker to shoot than we are." He turned to Mary. "Now, lady, if you please." Without argument, Mary started to remove her shorts. The second cop said kindly, "That isn't necessary, lady. Not the way those things are built. Just turn around slowly." "Thank you," Mary said and complied. The policeman's point was well taken. Mary's briefies appeared to have been sprayed on, and her halter also quite evidently contained nothing but Mary. "How about those bandages?" the first one commented. "Their clothes sure can't cover anything." I thought, "Brother, how wrong you are. I bet she's packing at least 2 guns this minute, besides the one in her purse. And I'll bet one of them is ready to heat up quicker than yours." But what I said was, "She's been badly burned, can't you see that?" He looked doubtfully at the sloppy job I had done on the dressings. I had worked on the principle that, if a little is good, more is better. And the dressing across her shoulders, where she had been burned the worst, undoubtedly could have concealed a slug, if that had been the purpose. He said. "If she was burned." "Of course she was burned." I felt my judgment slipping away. I was the perfect heavy husband, unreasonable where my wife was concerned. I knew it, and I liked it that way. "Damn it, look at her hair. Would she ruin a head of hair like that just to fool you?" The first cop said darkly, "One of them would." The more patient one said, "Carl is right. I'm sorry, lady. We'll have to disturb those bandages." I said excitedly, "You can't do that. We're on our way to a doctor. You'll just..." Mary said, "Help me, Sam. I can't take them off myself." I shut up and started to peel up one corner of the big dressing, my hands trembling with rage. Presently, the older, more kindly one whistled and said, "I'm satisfied. How about you, Carl?" "Mithuski. Christ, girlie. It looks like somebody tried to barbecue you. What happened?" "Tell them, Sam." So I did. The older cop finally commented, "I'd say you got off easy. No offense, madam. So it's cats now, huh?" "Dogs I knew about. Horses, yes, but cats. You wouldn't think the ordinary cat could carry one." His face clouded. "We got a cat, and now I have to get rid of it. My kids won't like that." "I'm sorry," Mary told him, and sounded as if she meant it. "It's a bad time for everybody. Okay, folks, you can go." "Wait a minute," the first one said. "Ski, if she goes through the streets with that thing on her back, somebody's likely to burn her." The older one scratched his chin. "That's true," he said to Mary. "I'd say you couldn't stand to have that dressing off. We'll just have to dig up a prowl car for you." Which they did. One was just landing, and they hailed it. I had to pay the charges on the rented wreck. Then I went along, as far as Mary's entrance. It was in a hotel, through a private elevator. I got in with her to avoid explanations, then went back up, after she had gotten out at a level lower than the obvious controls of the car provided for. I was tempted to go on in with her, but the old man had ordered me to come in by K-5. So K-5 it was. I was tempted, too, to put my shorts back on. In the prowl car, and during a quick march through a side door of the hotel, with police around us to keep Mary from being shot, I had not minded so much. But it took nerve to step out of the elevator and face the world without pants. I need not have worried. The short distance I had to go was enough to show me that a fundamental custom had gone with last year's frost. Most men were wearing straps. Cod pieces, really. As the cops had been. But I was not the only man in Brooklyn, stark naked to his shoes. One in particular, I remember. He was leaning against a street roof stanchion, and searching with cold eyes every passerby. He was wearing nothing but slippers, and a brassard lettering with V.I.G., and he was carrying an Owens mob gun under his arm. I saw three more like him before I reached K-5. I was glad that I was carrying my shorts. Some women were naked, some were not. But those who were not might as well have been. String brassieres, translucent plastic trunks, nothing that could possibly hide a slug. Most of the women, I decided, would have looked better in clothes, preferably togas. If this was what the preachers had been worrying about all these years, then they had been barking up the wrong tree. It was nothing to arouse the happy old beast in men. The total effect was depressing. That was my first impression, but before I got to my destination, even that had worn off. Ugly bodies weren't any more noticeable than ugly taxicabs. The eye discounted them automatically, and so it appeared to be with everybody else, too. Those on the streets seemed to have acquired utter indifference. Maybe Schedule Bareback got them ready for it. One thing I did not notice consciously until much later. After the first block, I was unaware of my own nakedness. I noticed other people long after I had forgotten my own bare skin. Somehow, some way, the American community had been all wrong about the modesty taboo, and had been wrong for centuries. When tackled firmly, it was as empty as the ghost that turns out to be a flapping window drape. It did not mean a thing, either pro or con, moral or immoral. Skin was skin, and what of it? I was led in to see the old man at once. He looked up and growled. "You're late." I answered, "Where's Mary?" "In the infirmary, getting treated and dictating a report. Let's see your hands." "I'll show them to the doctor, thanks," I replied, making no move to take off the gloves. "What's up?" "If you would ever bother to listen to a newscast," he grumbled, "you would know what was up." I'm glad I had not looked at the newscast. Our honeymoon would have never gotten to first base. While Mary and I had been telling each other how wonderful the other one was, the war had almost been lost, and I was not sure about that almost. My suspicion that the slugs could, if necessary, hide themselves in any part of the body and still control hosts had proved to be right. But I had guessed that from my own experience on the streets. It had been proved by experiments at the National Zoo before Mary and I had holed up on the mountain, although I had not seen the report. I suppose the old man knew it. Certainly the president knew it, and the other top VIPs. So, Schedule Suntan replaced Schedule Bareback, and everybody skinned down to the buff. Like hell they did. The matter was still top secret, and the subject of cabinet debates at the time of the Scranton riot. Don't ask me why it was top secret, or even restricted. Our government has gotten the habit of classifying anything as secret, which the all-wise statesmen and bureaucrats decide we are not big enough boys and girls to know. A mother-knows-best-dear policy. I've read that there used to be a time when a taxpayer could demand the facts on anything and get them. I don't know. It sounds utopian. The Scranton riot should have convinced anybody that the slugs were loose in Zone Green despite schedule bareback. But even that did not bring on schedule suntan. The fake air raid alarm on the East Coast took place, as I figured it, the third day of our honeymoon. There had not been any special excitement in the village when we visited it the day before that, and certainly no vigilante activity. After the false air raid alarm, it took a while to figure out what had happened, even though it was obvious that lighting could not fail by accident in so many different shelters. It gives me the leaping horrors to think about it even now. All those people crouching in the darkness, waiting for the all clear, while zombies moved about them, slapping slugs on them. Apparently in some air raid bunkers the recruitment was 100%. They did not have a chance. So there were more riots the next day, and we were well into the terror, though we did not know it. Technically the start of vigilanteism came the first time a desperate citizen pulled a gun on a cop. Maurice T. Kaufman of Albany, and the cop was Sergeant Malcolm McDonald. Kaufman was dead a half second later, and McDonald followed him in a few minutes, torn to pieces by the mob, along with his Titan master. But the vigilantes did not really get going until the air raid wardens put organization into the movement. The wardens, being mostly above ground at the time the coup in the bunkers took place, largely escaped. But they felt responsible. Not that all vigilantes were wardens, nor all wardens vigilantes, but a stark naked, armed man on the street was as likely to be wearing a warden's armband as a VIG brassard.